The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters,
relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 24, 2018, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is Greg Sargent from the Plumline blog at WashingtonPost.com. Greg's one of my favorite writers. I've been following his work for something like 15 years, since Blogosphere 1.0, way back in the day, when he wrote for Josh Marshall's Talking Points memo. His new book is called An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. By the way, if you like what you hear, please consider supporting the podcast by subscribing on our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/join/Bob and Chez. Sad to say it, but today is the perfect day to talk with Greg Sargent.
Hello.
Hey, Greg, it's Bob Seska. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Great, great. So I got to ask you, obviously, you're the guy to talk to today, given the topic of your book. What's the atmosphere like today at the Post? I mean, given how Amazon and Bezos are like Trump's sworn enemies, even more so than the failing New York Times. I mean, I would imagine things are pretty tense down there, huh?
I don't work in the building, so I'm not there today. I'm not sure what's going on. I haven't been really in direct touch with anybody, but I imagine things are pretty tense everywhere.
Yeah,
not
I would imagine
with the
so.
The Post, in every newsroom in the country.
Yeah, I mean, is this what we think it is? I mean, people acting on, or at least one person acting on Donald Trump's threats, Donald Trump's, his use of violent rhetoric and precipitating all of this?
Well, I think we don't really know who's behind this yet, and we don't really know if this person was precipitated by anything Trump said or did. It could be anything. It could be anybody, right? But one thing that I think we can say more broadly out and not necessarily in reference to this particular event is that Trump, really more than any figure in recent memory, has spent the last 18 months actively and deliberately stoking civil conflict on as many fronts as he conceivably can.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to, I think, recognize that he has done that not just because he's a raging jerk, but because he really firmly wants to divide the country because he thinks he benefits from it in some way.
Yeah.
It's a little hard to know exactly what's driving him at any given time, but it is simply objectively true that he has in every way possible tried to foment deep divisions and conflict.
Yeah. Do you think he realizes that his words set a tone in the country and that his words have consequences? Do you think he knows, or do you think he knows and just doesn't care, or doesn't he think that far ahead? Is everything happening in the eternal now, as they like to say?
It's very hard to know with him, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes it appears to be strategic. Sometimes he seems to be a lot more crafty than we give him credit for. Other times he seems to be acting on instinct. I find it may not be all that worthwhile to get into what's going on with his mental state. But
yeah,
when we observe his conduct, we can extrapolate from his conduct that he's doing what he's doing deliberately in some sense. It's not as if he's completely lost control and is just a raging asshole, if you will. He's actively stoking conflict wherever he can. It's been actually reported, and this never gets enough attention, although I shout about it until I'm hoarse a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
It's been reported in many cases that some of the worst stuff he's done, from the refusal to unambiguously condemn white supremacist violence to the attacks on football players for the act of protesting systemic racism, to the pardon of Joe Arpaio. He's done these things in the belief that his base will like them.
Yeah.
And so he is driven by what appears to be a desire to please his base by antagonizing the rest of the country.
Do you think this is the only way it ends, though? Do you think the only way for him to, and I want to get into in just a few minutes, you know, the what happens after the Trumpocalypse, as you say in your book. But is the only way this kind of rhetoric from him ends in some sort of violence that occurs that could be directly linked back to him? I mean, what does it actually take to get him to finally realize, or nothing? Is it nothing that will actually get him to realize how much damage he's actually creating every time he does one of these rallies, every time he starts tweeting?
I think it's hard to say. You can certainly imagine scenarios in which he manages to exit the political stage without causing serious civil unrest, I think.
Yeah.
For instance, you could see Democrats taking back the House and maybe Trump responding to that in a less crazy way than we expect. I mean, he's a bit of a survivor type underneath all this stuff, right?
Yeah.
And maybe the Mueller stuff kind of gets a little muddled in terms of what he actually found, and there's no impeachment, and then Trump decides not to run again and says, "I made America great," and exits, and then in that kind of scenario, I'm saying that this is a scenario you can envision in which maybe there isn't mass civil unrest if he essentially exits without anything really coming to a head, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like for the president to actually make a national address sitting at the Resolute desk and making in the Oval Office, making some sort of primetime address that says, you know what, let's call off all of this harsh rhetoric. Let's call off. I'm going to stop. You guys stop. We need to all stop this. But obviously there's no chance of that ever, ever, ever happening. So do you, I mean, just in a general view of the landscape, is there anything else? Is there any way to actually de-intensify, to de-escalate all of this and bring it back into some sort of level of civil control, some sort of way to calm the tensions? And it seems like he would be the only one to be able to do that, but he's not. He's not going to do it.
Right. I mean, I argue in the book for beyond Trump that in a general sense, maybe one way to ratchet things down a bit is to improve our institutions to the point where everyone, you know, stakeholders on all sides and people on all sides feel that the system's a little, the processes and democratic processes and so forth are a little bit more functional and fair.
Mm-hmm.
To make it a little easier for the losing side to cope with that. I mean, politics is in many ways about managing being on the losing side, right?
Yeah,
we have to figure out ways politics is about managing disagreement, I should say, and our institutions aren't doing a great job of that right now, but I propose a bunch of different things that I think could hopefully make things a little bit better.
Yeah, and we're already hearing at this point Republicans downplaying this. In fact, Rush Limbaugh just said, Republicans don't do this sort of thing. I mean, even the other day on Monday, Mitch McConnell was talking about how only one side is engaging in this, in sort of incendiary rhetoric and disrupting people while they're trying to order a BLT in Lexington, Virginia, or whatever it happens to be. I mean, what runs through your head when you see that sort of thing going on, where there's just no acceptance of responsibility from, you know, the party of personal responsibility?
Well, that's what today's Republican Party has become.
Yeah.
And, you know, Mitch McConnell, when he says that, he's just wallowing in a deep pit of bad faith, and no one should take it seriously for even a second.
Right.
I mean, he's one of the most singularly dishonest figures on the American scene in a very long time. And so we just have to sort of put up with his basically near nonstop lying.
Yeah.
you got to wonder at times when McConnell talks if he's actually giggling at his own cynicism.
Yeah, because, I was just going to say.
Right. Because it's just so saturated deeply in bad faith, it's almost hard to even imagine being that person. I've said this before, but you know, mob action is wrong on both sides. Mm-hmm. Defining mob action as something that's really, you know, not legitimate, that's something more than legitimate protest, right?
Yeah.
But I would argue that the mob action we've seen is asymmetric. It's worse on the right, I think. But even putting that aside, again, I don't understand how we can have any of these conversations about civility or mob action without placing absolutely at the center of the conversation the fact that the president has actively and deliberately and concertedly stoked civil conflict on every conceivable front that he can for 18 months. It is the central fact of our political life right now, and yet it's very hard to get people to acknowledge it forthrightly.
Yeah, I mean, he has been, in the book, you talk about fair play and the fact that Trump has basically abandoned, well, not basically, I mean, he has literally abandoned fair play. He has seen this gold mine of populism to be able to step into that, cloak himself in it, and exploit it for all it's worth, to completely blow apart how especially presidential level politics is actually played in this country. And obviously, you know, we've all talked about the fact that this is a pure cancer on the system. I mean, once you open this floodgate, is there any opportunity to close the floodgate again, or is it out there and we just have to deal with it as it comes?
Well, I mean, my feeling is that things can get a lot better depending on how these elections go. I really do think some of the flooding can be managed. So, for instance, imagine if Democrats take back the House. You could see a scenario in which they really exercise very serious oversight that Republicans have not exercised. And I think that could really improve people's confidence in the system, for one thing. And not to mention, actually, hopefully restore a little bit of accountability and transparency that's been entirely missing for the last 18 months. But beyond that, if Democrats can win a bunch of ground back on the state level, especially these big governorships, I really think things could get better. They can, Democratic governors can try and push for additional democracy enhancing reforms that could over time make a difference. The big one that I talk about in the book is that Democratic governors, if they take back, you know, some of these states, they can veto the terrible gerrymandered maps that Republican state legislators have been drawing. And it's important to understand this, and I hope your listeners will vote accordingly. Any governor elected this cycle, meaning in 2018, is going to be in power when the next round of redistricting is done in the next decade. And so the House is going to be redrawn, right? The House district lines are going to be redrawn, and these governors can veto these bad maps and force fairer ones. And that could actually have a real impact on the balance of power in the House of Representatives for a decade.
I mean, can these things, because you know what, I've proposed on many occasions too, and had conversations with never Trumpers about this concept, is that I always feel like this needs to be, any sort of post Trump reforms need to be somewhat bipartisan, where you get normals on the conservative side of the ledger, guys like Tom Nichols and Rick Wilson and Malcolm Nance and some people. Well, I don't think Malcolm Nance identifies as a Republican anymore, but nevertheless, I mean, you've got a lot of moderate conservatives who are against Trump and have always been against Trump, Bill Kristol, David Trump, and they seem to still have the capacity to communicate to other conservatives whether they support Trump or not. Do you feel like maybe this needs to be a both sides thing where we actually form some sort of coalition to push through some of these reforms to close up all of these loopholes that Trump has exposed in the system? Or can this be something that only the Democrats do, as you say, somewhat on the maybe on a state by state level or nationally at that?
Well, you know, I was very encouraged when I did a podcast with conservative writer Matt Lewis. He's a never Trumper, but he's a conservative, and he and I were actually able to agree on a number of the things that I suggested in the book. We didn't agree on everything, but he definitely found appeal in some of the compromise solutions that I suggested in terms of dealing with things like voter suppression and gerrymandering. Mm-hmm. And so I actually think that it is possible to create coalitions on this stuff. And to answer your question, though, it's probably going to be a bit of both, right? In some cases, Democrats are going to not be able to be joined by Republicans, and they'll try to get as far as they can on their own. In others, I think you will have some bipartisanship developing. I mean, look at automatic voter registration. Charlie Baker, the Republican governor up in New England, just signed one into law, I believe. And automatic voter registration is something that Republicans here and there have been able to support. And that's, I think, a major reform in terms of improving participation in the system. So I think both could happen.
I mean, and I think a major prong of this of Trumpism is completely verbal, and I don't know if there's any way to control verbal behavior, if there's any sort of constitutional amendment or any sort of law that will keep politicians from going there, from abandoning fair play, as you mentioned in the book. And you know, I see some of these rallies going on. I watched some of Obama's rallies for Democrats. Joe Biden was up there the other day. And the differences between seeing those rallies and seeing the Trump rallies is like night and day. They're just like completely two different things. Is there going to be a temptation, though, now that Trump has made this a successful thing where he can at least get the base all stoked, all fired up before election by doing these rallies? Is there going to be a temptation for the Democrats to start doing a similar kind of thing, but maybe in their own Democratic way? Or is this something that's going to be hopefully contained on the Republican side?
Well, I think I talk in the book about the fact that there's going to be a fair amount of pressure from the left on Democrats, should they take back some power, to go full procedural radical in response to what we've seen from Republicans, not just under Trump, but predating him. Mm-hmm. And what I try to propose in the book is kind of a balance or an equilibrium that I consider to be basically a liberal approach, which essentially says you can't unilaterally disarm. You're going to have to escalate the hardball in some areas here and there. But at the same time, Democrats should also stand for an ideal of fair play in politics, which we should strive for. And Democrats should be willing to represent or offer various types of compromises that can get us closer to that, and I suggest some of those in there. I think it's going to be a case by case kind of thing. It's going to kind of evolve as we go. It's a little hard to say how it'll go, but I just, my general argument here is that Democrats can't really follow Republicans over the cliff into this procedural nihilism that we're seeing in some quarters.
Yeah, well put.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and. And I think that there's ways to get the balance right. I mean, Democrats will do some escalating, I think, that in ways that will really piss Republicans off. But that's just sort of the nature of this. I do think there's a way to get the balance right between not unilaterally disarming, but also standing for fair play.
How do you convince certain elements of the left to go along with a process like this, knowing that I think a lot of discontentment on the left is stirred by a distrust or a lack of faith in the ability of the establishment Democratic Party, to actually accomplish anything real as far as progressive advances, certainly, but also just an overall reform of the system that, say, Bernie Sanders was calling for, Jill Stein was calling for. How do you bring those people along with you on this endeavor to seal up all of this insanity?
I don't know that you're going to be able to always do that. And yeah. I should say that the left is going to have a strong case to make for when they push Democrats to go full procedural radical, right? Mm. I mean, look what Republicans have been doing. We're back to the voter suppression already in multiple states.
Yep.
Right. We're looking at we're heading into an election where Democrats could very well win the popular vote by 4 or 5 points and still not end up in the majority. I mean, it's going to be tough to resist the argument from the left that why would you play around anymore and try to chase these guys, try to chase Republicans, try to chase compromise endlessly. I think, though, that a lot of activists, voting rights activist types, support some of these solutions, I think, though. Yeah. The ones that I talk about in the book, like things like nonpartisan redistricting commissions and so forth. So I think there are ways to find for the quote-unquote establishment and maybe the type of Democrat who's reluctant to go full procedural radical to find compromise with the left. I mean, there'll be a lot of disagreement, but that's politics, man.
Yeah. Because I've always seen this as being non-issue centric. I sort of see the fight for progressive issues being separate from the fight to reestablish these large umbrella-like institutions, the institution of the presidency, the institution of a political press in this country, and so on. These things that are gradually, or in some cases rapidly, being torn down and delegitimized by the current president and his supporters.
I think they're different.
Yeah,
one is procedural, the other is. I mean, there's, and I get into this in the book a bit, but you know, some on the left do argue that in a way these two things are fused, right? Like the case they make is that procedurally radical tactics are absolutely justified because we're facing a long-term emergency. They say, you know, look at climate change; it poses a dire threat. Inequality poses a dire threat to democracy itself and so forth. And so they would say that when you're faced with these types of threats, it's legitimate to go full procedural radical to realize solutions. And, you know, I think that's it's an interesting argument. And it seems to me that you got to sort of take it case by case and look at it as each of these opportunities comes up. And you basically weigh, you know, do the political and policy ends justify the procedural means that I'm considering? And I think that's going to be case by case. It's not easy to hit on a clear formula for dealing with that, for answering that question.
Yeah. I mean, in my estimation, I don't know if you agree with me on this, but it seems to me as if there's an opportunity here. Never, at least in my experience covering politics, I've never seen the right and the left unified on anything other than maybe 9/11. I've never seen the right and left unified in a way that it is right now. Regarding the reaction to Donald Trump. And I'm not obviously not talking about the red hats here. I'm talking about the never Trumpers, the moderate Republicans, and certainly the left is in complete agreement on this major, major crisis. And do you see this as an opportunity? I mean, can we really approach this as something that, you know, and it seems kind of idealistic to say this, knowing the way our politics are going in this country, but it seems like an opportunity that is too good to pass up. Do you think that that's something that's going to resonate into action or no?
Well, I think that's really interesting. I mean, I don't get so much into that in the book, but after doing this podcast with Matt Lewis, I sort of thought, well, you know, maybe there is ways to do this, you know? I mean, I proposed the generally proposed compromises, but then to actually have, you know, a prominent conservative agree with them is another matter. And so maybe there could be a recognition among some of the Never Trump types that a lot of the pathologies in the system are what enabled Trump, and maybe we should deal with some of these and avoid this happening again. Because, you know, as Matt Lewis said, in a way, it's actually a kind of a conservative set of, it's conservative to try to preserve the system, right?
Yeah.
And to deal with the pathologies. And so I think, you know, I hope, I just, who knows? I mean, it's going to be really fascinating to see what happens with the Never Trump movement once Trump is gone, no longer focusing it in the way it's been focused.
You know, and I definitely want to get back into elections and Trump's attempt to delegitimize elections, which you write about in the book, but just more about this moving forward, you know, the post-Trumpocalypse. Your last chapter references specifically the Trumpocalypse. And one of the things I keep thinking about, and the big question I still have is there going to be two histories written about this era? I mean, do you think facts and reality are going to calcify into one sort of generally agreed upon history? Or are we moving forward now where there's going to be a red hat history, and then there's going to be a history for the normals, and that's going to be constantly, you know, historians of the future are going to constantly be batting that one back and forth and debating which one is the accurate one, or is reality going to win out in the long run?
I mean, I think in some ways it is actually kind of winning out now. I mean, I reserve the right to revise that assessment after this election.
Yeah.
But you know, if the election goes well, I think there are signs that reality is winning, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, not maybe as decisively as we would like, but let's go through it, right? So solid majorities think that the Mueller probe is absolutely legitimate in pursuing potential wrongdoing.
True.
Majorities trust the news media to tell them the truth rather than Trump. Majorities disapprove of Trump's rhetoric about the media. Now, to be clear, that there is some disapproval and some discontentment with the media, but that's fine. I think what we can have really seen is that majorities tend to understand Trump's attacks on the media to be fundamentally undemocratic and authoritarian, and aren't buying into them. And so, you know, majorities, according to Quinnipiac polling, say Trump's a racist and trying to divide the country and dividing the country, right? So I think it seems to me that majorities understand him as the threat to our democratic values that he really is. So it seems to me his lies are mostly failing. I mean, again, if Democrats don't win the popular vote by enough to take the House, maybe it would be time to revise that. But there are certainly signs that reality could be in the process of winning, put it that way.
Yeah. And, you know, ever since Blogosphere 1.0, and you know, as I said earlier, you used to write for Talking Points Memo and a website that I continuously look at throughout the day, still to this day. But we've all been ranting about the false equivalence in the news. And in fact, Andrea Mitchell today was on MS saying that talking about anger on both sides in the context of these attempted bombings and so on, just shaking my head and just, you know, like, when does this end? How does this continue to even be a thing, even after all these years, Greg?
I don't understand it. And on top of that, what makes it even crazier is that Trump is trying to destroy their profession.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, and the liberal critique of the media is certainly, it can be partisan, it can be vitriolic and so forth and so on, but it's fundamentally in line with the press's core liberal democratic values. I mean, liberals just want the press to do a better job a lot of the time. And and inform people better. That's not what Trump and his movement want. They want to destroy the media's institutional role. And so for the very same people who are in those crosshairs to be drawing an equivalence between people who fundamentally support them and people who are trying to destroy them is just one of the weirdest disconnects you can even imagine existing.
Yeah. I mean, in the Bob Woodward book, he talks about how Steve Bannon was initially approaching Donald Trump to run for president. I think it was back in 2010 or something like that. And one thing that Steve Bannon mentioned to Trump and in the early discussions about getting him to throw his hat in the ring, he was talking about how leaders and especially future leaders in this country, are going to be, quote unquote, managing the decline. Which jumped off the page to me. I mean, in fact, it was something that kind of terrified me a little, that there's this dominating attitude in certain kind of DC cocktail party circuit circles that we're riding the decline down. And my fear is that so many people in the traditional press are kind of looking at this whole thing as now covering the decline rather than where basically they've accepted the fact that this is all, this entire American experiment in democracy is slowly disintegrating, and they've just taken the position, you know, and this kind of attitude to me jumps out when I see people, members of the White House press corps, laughing along with Donald Trump's jokes and so on. And I start to think, good Lord, and I try not to be cynical like this, but I'm going, have they just accepted the decline? Is there a decline? Do you see the same sort of thing going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting way to put it. I mean, my instinct would have been to say that when they're laughing along with Trump and so forth, that they have their heads in the sand about the true nature of the threat, which would, that would sort of dovetail pretty well with what I said earlier about how they don't seem to be willing to recognize that he's trying to destroy their institutional role completely.
Yeah.
Right. But it's interesting to consider the idea, as you say, that it's more like kind of laughing on the sinking, people having one last laugh as the ship goes down.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's hard. It's a little hard. I don't know how you'd be able to figure out which it is, but, it's certainly it's a powerful picture you paint there.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always consider the source, too. I mean, because it's Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon has some crazy ideas, a lot of them informed by the occult, and I don't know what. I don't know where he gets these crazy ideas, but he's not an unsmart guy. I mean, Steve Bannon, for all his evil tendencies, tends to have a pretty clear view of what's going on around him, at least. And so, yeah, that was one of the things that just screamed out of the Bob Woodward book to me. I mean, all the Trump crap aside, that Steve Bannon quote kind of terrified me. It's just, I hope that isn't the dominating attitude inside Washington, where they're lighting them up because they're going down, an attitude kind of like that. So, but,
that is interesting.
In the book, you talk about something called constitutional hardball. Tell us about that concept and how that's entered into regular practice.
Well, so constitutional hardball, there's a sort of academically strict definition of it, and then there's a little bit more of a kind of journalists on the street definition of it. Mm. The strict academic definition, more or less, and I'm oversimplifying here, is that it's when political actors act in a way that violates previous accepted understandings of what constitutes legitimate political behavior.
Yeah,
That's the gist of it, and I that's useful enough. As the more general journalistic definition of that is kind of like that. It's you know, when you behavior that you just know by looking at it that it's really destructive or self-evidently on its face deeply unfair to the opposition or doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the opposition. And so a lot of the story I tell in the book is from Gingrich onwards, because he really put a lot of this stuff in motion.
Right.
And basically what I do is I sort of chart the development of Republican constitutional hardball as against Democratic constitutional hardball. And both sides have had their moments, for sure. There's no question of playing hardball, but it's asymmetric.
Yeah.
Is the case I make, that Republicans have played political hardball to a far greater and more destructive degree than Democrats have. And by the way, I think some conservatives might even agree with that and say so. I mean, you know, it's perfectly legit. It's allowed, they would say. I mean, and so that's really the core point, is that the question is, should it be allowed, right?
Yeah.
And so that's really what I tell, and I think we saw it most visibly in the last couple of years with McConnell refusing to hold a hearing on Merrick Garland, and I think that has poisoned the well to a degree that really was much worse than what had come before it, even though things had been very bad during the most of the Obama years too. So anyway, that's constitutional hardball. It's Republicans have practiced it much more readily than Democrats have, although both have done it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think to return to what you said earlier, the left is going to have a strong case to Democrats if they take back power. It's time to play the game the way they do. And I try to propose what I hope is a bit of a balanced answer to that.
Yeah. Yeah. And you do a great job of it too. I mean, is it,
oh, thank you.
Is it also germane to the conversation about all of this to discuss who started the fire, whether it has to do with the asymmetrical nature of constitutional hardball or when it comes to uncivil language and uncivil tactics being used allegedly. And they're obviously, to me at least, it seems like in an age where this ongoing fire hose of news just completely blows away whatever news story occurred 5 minutes ago in lieu of whatever is happening now, it seems to me as if it's important to always be reminding just the general population, whether it's on social media or whether it's on the blogs or so on, reminding everyone how this de-evolution began, whether it's you know, the downward slope from George W. Bush through Sarah Palin to Donald Trump with the Tea Party in between, or whether it's the escalation of incivility in politics or constitutional hardball. Is this a discussion that we should also be having too, like what the history of this is, as we, you know, debate what's happening now? Do we also talk about how this got started?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I say in the book is that it's a little hard to say at any given moment who's to blame for a particular thing, and that's it's sort of the nature of this type of deterioration that it's tit for tat, like one side is responding to another at any given moment, and at some moments it's one party doing it, at other moments the other party doing it. It's kind of the nature of this type of tit-for-tat escalation stretching out over years that makes it hard to, that very nature makes it hard to assess blame. But I think overall what we do need to keep focused on is how deeply and fundamentally undemocratic some Republicans' behavior has been, or conduct has been. And I think we can say that Democrats have certainly had their moments and played their share of hardball, while also saying Republicans in some much more fundamental way are really essentially behaving often in an undemocratic manner. And I think it is important to focus on that.
How tethered to values are the Republicans anymore? Or is this more about a strategy to win elections than it is about actual hardcore, a central set of values, a central set of policies and so on? Or is this just all about now whatever we can do to own the libs and win elections? That's all that matters on the right.
It sort of depends, right, on who we're talking about. I think McConnell doesn't sort of feel driven by that own the lib sentiment in a way that, you know, I don't know, someone like Tom Cotton or very Trumpist elected officials do, right? McConnell seems to be motivated by things like by a deep cynicism and a desire to win at all costs.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, Rick Wilson once said that Mitch McConnell doesn't care about your screaming, which I thought was so salient. That's just a great way to put it, because he doesn't. He doesn't care about what anyone says. He's got his strategy and he's sticking with it.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so it sort of depends on the particular political actor. But, you know... It's there certainly does seem to be an outbreak of own the libsism, if you can call it that, that right. seems to have really escalated in a major way in recent. It just feels to me like a lot of the time the Trumpist types really don't know what the hell they're fighting for, except on immigration they really seem to. But, you know, half of the Trumpists that you see on social media, it's hard to imagine that they're driven by any real values at this point other than own the libism.
Right. I mean, is there a bigger political hoax that you've seen than the so-called hoax of voter fraud? The entire myth of voter fraud seems to be something that returns every time there's another national election, and it just simply does not exist, and yet it keeps coming up time and time again. Apart from there not being an equivalence of this on the left in any stretch, is there a bigger hoax, a bigger myth in terms of the the problems surrounding elections than voter fraud?
Well, this is certainly one of the biggest ones, and it, as you say, it does keep coming back. One thing that I talk about in the book, one of my favorite interviews in there is with a Republican pollster who is really quite candid about what's driving Republican voters on this stuff. He essentially, this is a prominent Republican pollster, he's named in the book, who has conducted focus groups and polling of Republican voters for many years. And told me, and I have him quoted in there, told me that that for many Republican voters, they see voter suppression as a justified response to what they see as a borderline criminal alliance between the Democratic Party and minority voters, and including undocumented immigrant voters. And he's quite candid that a lot of it has to do with race. And it's pretty striking stuff how deeply they've bought into this whole voter fraud myth.
You know, in your book, you talk about Trump's attempts to delegitimize elections, and we've all seen examples of that. How do you think Trump's going to react to the midterms if the House flips, if things don't go his way?
I think we can only guess, right? Hasn't he already telegraphed that he's going to say that the outcome was illegitimate?
Yeah, he has. Yeah, he was talking at his rally the other night. He was talking about going back to the old illegal immigrants voting myth that was entirely debunked by his own failed voter fraud commission, which is just amazing to know that, right? To know that it wasn't just the left debunking the illegal voter situation that doesn't exist. It was his own voter fraud commission and Kris Kobach
right.
and all
nothing.
That. Yeah.
And they're still talking about it anyway.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And obviously there are things that have been happening, like gerrymandering, what we were talking about before with regard to that and some of the obvious voter suppression that we've seen going on. But, I mean, have we ever seen a sitting president who is so actively delegitimizing an election even before it happens?
Well, I think we saw it in 2016, which was remarkable. And I write about this too. He went out on the campaign trail and said the outcome will be illegitimate unless I win. I don't know how much clearer you can be than that. It's a straight up declaration that the political system, the only legitimate outcomes the political system can produce are ones that his support, that in which his supporters are victorious. So he's very clear on this point, crystal clear, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, it all benefits him. It gives him something to say. It gives his people something to be angry about, more grievances to toss onto the fire. And the thing that I keep thinking about, Greg, is now we've also seen people like Dana Loesch talking about making sure you bring your firearms to your polling places because the Democrats are going to attack you. Good timing on that one, isn't it? So there seems to be not just a delegitimization of the election and happening preemptively, but also they're throwing into the mix this, this level of fear that goes from everything from the caravans on through to African-American voters on through to, liberal thugs and angry mobs disrupting elections, too. I can't help but to think, and please talk me down on this, I can't help but to think that this continues to escalate and gets worse before it goes better. And I'm talking specifically about creating this level of chaos around the democratic process itself. I mean, literally our elections.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely as worried as you are, that's for sure. I think that there's a lot to what you're saying there. A lot of this sort of stuff about these calls for people to monitor the polls with arms and so forth are really about suppressing the vote, aren't they?
Yeah.
About keeping, scaring people away from voting. It's the goal is the opposite of what it claims to be.
One of the things one question that you ask in your book, and then I'll let you go after this. But I mean, how do the Democrats get tougher? I mean, one of your subheadings is it time for Democrats to get much tougher? How do Democrats get tougher without necessarily crossing that line? And then does it even resonate if they don't, given that the other side is already off slinging shit at everything and in every direction? They're already like poop flinging monkeys on one side. How do you get people's attention if you're not willing to go that far? Just sort of returning to something we were discussing earlier as well.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. And I grapple with it. And I find that it's a really complicated and difficult one with no easy solutions. And so I really firmly believe that this is going to be case by case.
Yeah.
That a lot of it will be dictated by whatever situations come up. I mean, if you look at Obamacare passing, for instance, that was an interesting, I think, way of escalating the hardball that seems to me to have been pretty justified, right? Obama and Democrats really made a good faith effort to win over some Republican senators. It turned out that they were all operating in bad faith and were never going to support anything. And I'm oversimplifying the story, but at the end of the day, they ended up using some procedural hardball to get it through. And, it felt to me like the balance was pretty close to right in that case, because they, at a certain point, they had to escalate a bit. Otherwise, they had just won an election and they represented a majority, and they won by popular majorities, right? Unlike this guy. And so I really do think it's case by case. But the important thing I try to argue in the book is that it's possible, I think, to pick your shots and escalate carefully, right? Not indiscriminately. Escalate carefully where it's really justified, but also getting the balance right with other efforts to try and restore fairness to the system and a spirit of fair play. I do think the balance can be gotten right. I hope it can be. It'll be something that will be, I think, caused, it'll be produced by fitful experimentation and a lot of arguing among Democrats, but hopefully they can get the balance right.
This is something I'm thinking about a lot, is are we basically just misreading the nature of this crisis? Is there even a shot that we're just kind of looking at this in the same way? Because I remember, I first started reading you at Talking Points Memo back during the Bush administration, Blogosphere 1.0, and some of the things that we're saying about Trump, we were kind of saying about Bush in a very embryonic kind of way, if you compare the two administrations.
True.
And what was being said about that. Is this just the left being angry because we're not getting the issues that we want and some of the things that we love are getting rolled back or so on? Or is this like, is this legitimately a crisis? Are we all correct about that? Because I always say, you know, I wish I was wrong about Trump. I mean, from top to bottom, I wish I was wrong about everything, but I don't think that I am. Are we wrong, or in your estimation, or are we just really kind of as close to the mark as you could possibly get?
I mean, it's a really good question. And the way I try to answer it in the book is to say, I think we're probably going to get through this.
Yeah.
It seems to me that our institutions are holding up largely.
So far, so good.
The media has retained its core independence, and it's actually, in many respects, performing magnificently in this era. There's a lot of innovation about in the among the press and introspection about how to handle this level of disinformation and lying and deception. The rule of law is holding up, even though it's kind of getting knocked around a little bit. So, like I said, I think you can really see your way clear to a place where we'd look back on this and say, you know, it got pretty rough and tumble there, but everything held together.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think things could get a lot worse if Republicans hold on to the House, but you really can envision scenarios where your former depiction was turned out to be the right one, right? Where we look back on this and say, well, you know, we were all very pissed off, but we were on the losing end for a couple of years there, and you know, the system kind of worked. We all mobilized, civil society mobilized. We got up off of our asses and got out there and won back some ground, and now things are getting a little more balanced. I could see that. I sure hope it goes that way.
Well, the book is called An Uncivil War, Taking Back Our Democracy in an Age of Trumpian Disinformation and Thunderdome Politics. I just love the Thunderdome Politics part of that title, too. Just yeah. Was so well said. And good luck with the book, Greg. And boy, what a perfect time to just dig into this book with everything that's happening, not only today, but what's happened since the 2015 and 2016, for that matter. So thank you Greg. Really appreciate your time today.
Yep, thank you, Bob. Great conversation. Appreciate it.
Take it easy. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Well, I feel a little more confident we can bottle this crap. Maybe we can start that process in a couple of weeks, huh? Once again, the book is called An Uncivil War. There's a link in the description below. It's one of the must-read volumes of this era, so I urge you to pick up a copy. Okay, coming up tomorrow, the great Jody Hamilton joins us for another Thursday show, followed by Kimberly A. Johnson on Friday. And we're working on getting Esquire's Charlie Pierce for next Wednesday's pre-election interview show. Take care, folks. See you next time. Bye-bye.